Explore the tropics at Whole Foods Market through April 16th. Save on juicy finds like yellow mangoes at 5 for $5 with Prime. Sweet Dacopan citrus is back, just $3.49 per pound with Prime. Plus, save on seasonal favorites like dragon fruit, kiwi, pineapple, and more. In the meat department, pick up animal welfare certified meats with tropical-inspired marinades. And be sure to try the spicy Hawaiian pizza, back for a limited time. Only at Whole Foods Market.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
It was Halloween night when he decided to strike, which, as I'm sure you'll agree, made for the perfect backdrop for a bloody crime. But before I get ahead of myself here, let me assure you that there was no one hurt in the making of this news story. But as the old adage goes, if it bleeds, it leads. And this was certainly true from the robbery at the Spokane Blood Bank. Now, at the time, blood bank robberies weren't actually unheard of. They often had cash on hand and very minimal security. The papers reported that on the night of October 31st of 1957, a man stepped through the Spokane Blood Bank's doorway and approached Billy Evelyn Miller, the only medical technician on duty. He saw her, and she saw him. The man then calmly produced a pistol. This wasn't a typical bank robbery, though. He wasn't there after some quick cash. No, he was there to find something far more valuable to him: human blood. In a steady voice, he asked for 5 units of type O negative and 4 sets of transfusion equipment. Based on the words he used, Billy Evelyn thought that he must have had a higher degree of medical understanding than your average run-of-the-mill thief. He was also polite and, in her words, very calm and sweet, telling her, "I won't hurt you, my dear. Just don't be frightened. Do what I tell you." And although he was brandishing a gun, he was careful not to aim it at Billy Evelyn. So she obliged, handing the items over. He packed his bag full of blood and tubes and needles and asked her not to watch as he left and to wait 5 minutes before calling the police. She complied, and he quietly made his smooth escape. What drove the man to rob the blood bank would remain a mystery. 6 detectives were assigned to the case, but they turned up nothing. The police speculated that the robber could have needed the blood for something that occurred outside the law: a gunshot wound, or perhaps an abortion. They noted that type O negative blood is often characterized as a universal donor, meaning that it can be used in all cases and is often deployed in the direst of situations in which a perfect match may take longer to find. The value of blood is not to be understated. Globally, and in a metaphorical sense, it represents life itself, the sticky force that keeps us all on this earth. Blood is an important component in our world religions and foundational tales of civilizations. It's been used in rituals across the world as offerings to the gods and appeasements to forces beyond our understanding. It's found its way from our arteries into larger-than-life symbolism that we live with every day. And the English language is ripe with common phrases that invoke the idea of blood. These blood-borne idioms illustrate some of our most intense human experiences. For example, something terrifying might make your blood curdle. To have blood on your hands means that you've done something irrevocably harmful. To be after blood means that you might stop at nothing to get what you want. And these are just a few. The list is seemingly endless. We can't understand who we are as humankind without first understanding more about the substance that flows through our veins and keeps us living. We need to wrap our minds around how it's been understood and misunderstood across time and place, and what happens when that blood is spilled. I'm Aaron Mankey, and welcome to Bedside Manners. Close your eyes and come with me. Picture this. You're sitting in a room. It's musty, but bright and full of conversation and the occasional moan. Beside you, a man is working near someone's head with a pair of scissors. You hear the sharp shearing sound of metal on metal as he works. Fine hairs catch the light as they flutter to the ground. Nearby, another man is bent over and peering into the gaping mouth of a wincing woman. You can smell, even from some feet away, that her insides have gone rancid. A shrill cry escapes her throat as the metal implement scrapes deeper. Looking toward the windows, you spy bowls lined up like neat and tidy soldiers, all arranged by size. They're filled with a liquid that seems to swallow the sun. Then the smell of iron hits you, and you realize that those bowls are filled with blood. This scene might have the ingredients of a torture chamber, but all of the people are there quite willingly. Still sitting, you see that your hand is stretched out and clutching onto a pole. The pole has a dual purpose. It helps you keep your arms straight and serves as an object to grasp tightly, all to make what's about to happen easier. A man in an apron approaches you. In his hands, he holds a small, flat, silver box with a hinged top. He sets it on the table, then wraps a piece of cloth around your arm, a tourniquet. The veins in your arm start to bulge. The man then opens the box he set down, pulls out an instrument, and unfolds it. It resembles something like a pocket knife, a white handle, and a short, double-edged metal blade. The practitioner easily positions the blade at just the right angle he wants. He's done this many times before. But before he makes any cuts, he places an ornate pewter bowl beneath your arm. And then, he slices into your bulging vein. Blood runs down your forearm. It feels warm as it begins to drip into the bowl in plips and plops, as you and the man, your barber surgeon, watch. Your head feels light, the room fades, and finally you slump over, because you have passed out. When you awake, the barber surgeon is smiling at you with satisfaction, knowing that he has done his job perfectly. You have a bandage on your arm, and the bleeding has ceased. You'd come to him after all because you were ill. And now, with the excess blood removed and your humors restored, you are on the road toward healing. Bloodletting, you see, was fundamental to caring for the human body for over 2,000 years. Throughout history, it was practiced in some form by almost all cultures and societies. Though it seems like a total counterintuitive practice, blood is our life force after all. For a long time, the practice was considered to be cutting edge. And yes, that pun was intentional. For a large part of history, quality and quantity of blood were thought to govern the quality and quantity of a person's years. The practice of phlebotomy, the letting of blood, is thought to have originated in ancient Egypt, with the first evidence of the practice appearing around 1500 BC. It's believed that the earliest proponents of therapeutic bloodletting took their cues from spontaneous forms of bloodletting, such as menstruation and nosebleeds. It was with thanks to the ancient physician Hippocrates, though, that this specific healing modality gained a lot of momentum. Over 2,300 years ago, Hippocrates hypothesized that illnesses stemmed from natural rather than supernatural causes. He proposed that healing was a matter of proper bodily maintenance and not from tributes to the gods. He adapted his ideas on some pre-scientific thought that originated before his time, and after some percolating, he came up with his theory of the four humors. Hippocrates believed that nature is represented in four elements: earth, air, water, and fire. It made sense to him then that humans also might be comprised of four corresponding liquids, called humors, and he decided that these were blood, phlegm, black bile, and yellow bile. Each humor was ascribed to a certain organ and related to one of four certain personality types. Illness was attributed to humoral imbalance, too much of one thing and not enough of another. In order to get yourself back in balance, a doctor would be prescribing any number of things: bloodletting, purging, diuresis, and fasting. Of course, there were folks who completely disagreed with Hippocrates, but his ideas would be built upon and gain wider acceptance long after his time. The physician Galen inherited these ideas. He was born in Turkey in 129 AD, and 20 years later, he took to the road to study with some of the most preeminent medical teachers of the time. He settled permanently in Rome in the early 160s, stirring up business with public demonstrations and lectures. By this time, he had become wholly fixated on blood, becoming phlebotomy's most prolific proponent. That said, he knew it wasn't something to be taken lightly. Cutting a person was something to be done with much precision and care. He deemed bloodletting to be an essential remedy to all that ailed folks, and as a safeguard against what might afflict them in times to come. Blood, Galen thought, was the root of all sickness. Sometimes you had bad blood, and sometimes you might have too much of it. This, according to him, could be diagnosed from external observations. One just had to look for a ruddy complexion, a sluggishness, or maybe a rapid pulse. He and his contemporaries became quick to prescribing bloodletting as a remedy for just about everything. Galen would go on to become one of the most prolific authors in Western antiquity, his total writing output exceeding 2 million words. He wrote on a variety of topics, but he's best remembered for his outsized impact on medicine. And as the empire expanded, so too did the reach of Galen's medical theories. Bloodletting, it seems, was here to stay. So next time you reach for an aspirin or have to run out for more cold medicine, just think, this could all be so much worse. Because for a very long time, it was. King Charles II of England was having a rough go of it in the winter of 1685. His feet ached, and despite tending to them, they continued to be a nuisance. So he decided to cancel his daily walk and go for a carriage ride instead. As you'll see, it would be his last. The king retired to bed early that night, but his sleep would be anything but restful. By morning, he awoke moaning and barely able to speak. His aides hustled in alarm. He was soon struck by a seizure. Doctors from the Royal College of Physicians quickly arrived at his bedside and deployed an arsenal of treatments. They took out their enemas, the purgatives, the laxatives. They ground up sugar and pearls for a tonic. They put the irons in the fire, literally. And of course, they brought out their lancets. This was top-tier medical technology. There would be nothing but the best for their king. With these tools in hand, the mettle of the king was put to the test. The old adage, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, seems like it was particularly applicable here. He drank boiled spirits from a human skull, hoping that its former vitality would reinvigorate him. He was scalded from head to toe by white-hot irons and bled from his jugular vein. But he knew the end was near. The king apologized to his doctors for having such an unconscionable time dying. After 6 days, King Charles II slipped from this life. In total, he had about 24 ounces of blood taken over the course of his treatment. What we have since learned is that a human body can replace 16 ounces of the stuff within 2 days. This, though, is assuming that the body is healthy. It seems that Charles probably needed all the blood he could get, and it's likely that his body couldn't keep up with the reproduction of it. And due to the number of physical ailments, it seems that his body simply gave out. He was beyond repair. In the centuries following Galen, bloodletting continued to be widely considered as a cure-all and was incredibly common. For a while, the practice was in the hands of the clergy, which actually made a lot of sense. They were an educated class and were often tasked with caring for the sick. But after Pope Alexander III banned his holy men and women from the practice in 1163, a void appeared, and the barber surgeons would fill that role. Once upon a time, the local barber surgeon was a one-stop shop for various kinds of bodily maintenance: hair cutting, teeth pulling, and of course, bloodletting. Their job was to tend to things considered to be dirty and deeply personal. These practitioners were tradesmen, rather than high society physician types. They worked with bodies, something that was considered to be uncouth, whereas physicians looked but didn't touch. In England, it was common to see candy cane striped poles outside of barber surgeon shops, with the red representing blood and the white representing the tourniquet. Bowls of blood were even set in the windows as advertising. Remember that the next time you go and see the same pole outside your own barber shop. Over the years, their tools of the trade evolved. Animal teeth, sharpened wood, and shells gave way to spring lancets and razor-sharp instruments known as scarificators. But as theories around the practice grew more complex, the tools became more precise. One of the most popular aids in bleeding were small, soft, and sentient: leeches. They were placed on the problem area, both on the outside and on the inside of the body. If you have never heard of a leeching chair and wonder why it might have a hole in the seat, well, consider yourself lucky. The popularity of leeches peaked in France in the 1830s when it was thought that about 35 million of them were used per year. The most popular variety, the Hirudo medicinalis, was capable of ingesting 10 times its own weight of blood at each feeding. They were housed in ornate jars in apothecary windows, which were filled with comfortable beds of pebbles and moss. for the leeches to retire upon between gigs. In fact, for a very long time, they were believed to have gone extinct thanks to this high demand. They're actually still around today, but they are a protected species. And of course, they've had to go back to finding their own meals. But not before taking the blame for the deaths of some very famous historical figures. George Washington had really taken to retirement. He found a lot of satisfaction in watching the seasons change at his estate at Mount Vernon, Virginia. His time and attention had shifted away from public service, and now he spent his hours tending to his land. Thursday, December 12th of 1799, started off with light snow, then hail, and then rain. Conditions weren't kind, to say the least. Nevertheless, Washington hopped on his horse to supervise his plantation activities. It was a long, cold, wet day in the saddle. When he returned home that evening, he was chilled to his core. Guests had just arrived for dinner. A friend suggested that he change into something warm and dry. Washington, however, was a stickler for punctuality and chose not to do so. He chose to take a seat at the meal, still freezing. The next morning, Washington woke up with a sore throat and later complained of a cough and a runny nose. Still, there were chores to do outside and 3 fresh inches of snow to contend with. So despite the frigid air and his sore throat, Washington headed out to mark trees that he wanted to have cut down. His voice grew more hoarse throughout the day, and by the time he returned to read his evening newspapers aloud, he could barely manage. He chose to retire for the night, but he wouldn't sleep for long. He woke up around 2 a.m., clutching his chest, short of breath, and with a raging fire in his throat. Even so, he wouldn't allow Martha to get up and call for help. She was recovering from a cold herself, and he didn't want her to have to leave the warm comforts of their bed. At daybreak, Caroline Branham, one of the people enslaved by the Washingtons, came to light a fire in the bedroom. It was then that Martha sent for Washington's secretary, Tobias Lear. He arrived quickly and was startled to find the former president in such bad shape. He sent for George Rawlins, an overseer at Mount Vernon, as well as Washington's personal doctor of over 40 years, Dr. James Craik. At around 7:30 a.m., while waiting for Dr. Craik to arrive, Rawlins, at the request of Washington and despite Martha's vocal opposition, bled the former president, taking about 14 ounces of blood. Over the course of the morning, panic set in. Another doctor was called, who also opted to bleed an additional 18 ounces of blood. A third bloodletting occurred at 11 a.m., drawing out another 18 ounces, and then they sent for yet another doctor. Washington's condition, unsurprisingly, continued to deteriorate. A fourth physician was called for, who conducted one final 32-ounce bleeding. The doctors tried giving him teas. They tried having him gargle various tonics. They tried administering enemas. They blistered him with Spanish fly. They even induced vomiting. As you can imagine, it was all a pretty gruesome sight. And if you were wondering if Washington knew that he was dying, the answer unequivocally was yes. At 4:30 p.m., he called for his wills. He gave directions on how to settle his books and accounts. He thanked his doctors and asked to be decently buried, and specified that his body not be put into his vault any less than 3 days after he had died, for fear that he might mistakenly be buried alive. But die he did, just a few hours later, at the age of 67. Washington, though, wasn't the only high-profile person to possibly be bled to death. There were others, too. It's thought that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and Lord Byron both succumbed with the aid of bleeding. Conversely, there was the case of Marie Antoinette, in which it was suggested that bloodletting may have actually saved her life, for a time. You see, in 1778, Marie was pregnant with her first child, Marie Therese. When it came time for the then Queen of France to give birth in December of that year, Marie's bedroom in the Palace of Versailles was filled with onlookers, eager to see the birth of the Queen's first child, who everyone hoped would be a male heir to the crown. At that time, it was custom to have public births in the French court. People wanted to witness the heir's corporeal debut. So the Queen's room was packed with gawkers, so many, in fact, that they not only hindered the work of the attending doctors, but they also made the room itself loud, suffocating, and unbearably hot. People stood on cabinets, climbed tapestries, and crowded all around just to get a glimpse. King Louis XVI ordered that the tapestry screens around the Queen's bed be secured with strong cords so that they wouldn't collapse on her due to the rush of people clamoring to get a glimpse of the birth. The scene was chaotic and overwhelming. This was all amplified when Marie did eventually give birth, not to a son which she had so deeply hoped for, but to a daughter. All of this was too much for Marie, it seems, and she passed out. As if she hadn't already lost enough blood for the day, the doctors sprung into action. They sliced an incision in the queen's foot. Sure enough, she opened her eyes and stirred once more. Bloodletting in this case seems to have helped revive her, or it could also be that the pain of the incision had brought her back around, or that the crowd was dispersed and the king frantically opened all the windows to let in some fresh air. But this, of course, would not be the last time that Marie Antoinette would be bled. 14 years later, a much more, shall we say, comprehensive session of bloodletting would occur at the gallows, when Marie was executed after a trial found her guilty of high treason. Bloodletting may or may not have saved her before, but this second instance certainly did what it was designed to do, and it brought her life to an end. You might be wondering to yourself, with all of these cases of bloodletting potentially having gone wrong, why did so many think it was right? The advent of germ theory in the 1860s dealt a hard blow to humoral theory. Even still, it's been documented that bloodletting didn't reach its peak in Europe until around the same time. Books on the topic continued to be published into the next century. For poor old George Washington, it's unknown to this day exactly what killed him. Almost immediately after his death, doctors began debating what had dealt America's first president the final blow. Some suggested an abscess in his mouth, while others believed it was a blockage in his throat. Some even attributed his death to pneumonia and strep. Whatever the true reason, they removed about 80 ounces of blood, or around 40% of the amount of blood in the average adult, all in 12 hours. And this surely could not have helped the man. The practice of bloodletting progressively dwindled in the 19th century in the West, and in retrospect seems barbaric to our modern minds. It has not vanished altogether, though, and it's still used to treat certain conditions related to bone marrow and metabolism disorders. But on a more basic, fundamental level, think about your annual physical. They take your height, your weight, your blood pressure, and they also bleed you, drawing your blood through needles and into tubes. Science has gotten a lot better, of course. The blood is no longer drawn for its own therapeutic sake, but for the purpose of running various tests on it. We now look at taking blood as a means to an end, rather than the therapy itself, a first necessary step toward a more precise diagnosis and treatment. And I'm sure you'd be happy to know that the use of medical leeches is making a comeback in modern medicine, particularly in microsurgery. It appears that the leeches release various biological substances that can help reduce venous congestion and prevent tissue necrosis. If you'll pardon the pun, it's pretty common for folks today to think the healthcare practitioners of yore, well, sucked. But as their leeches seem to have taught us, it turns out they were onto something. Blood and guts. That's a term we've heard often as a general description of what's inside our bodies. And hopefully today you've gained new insights into the long and winding journey that blood has traveled throughout history. But as you might expect for something so ubiquitous, there are plenty of stories of blood out there waiting to be retold. And if you stick around through this brief sponsor break, you'll get to hear one more of them.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
In 2018, the mummified body of an 11th century Italian saint was discovered in a church in Lucca, Italy. Saint Divinus of Armenia had died in a hospital annexed to the church in the year 1050. During a complete study of the body, scientists located two significant wounds on his skull, thought to be produced by a serrated blade and a blunt instrument. They noticed precise scarifications around the wound, which appeared to indicate that while he was alive, it had been cleaned and cauterized. Researchers believe that this is the first physical evidence of a case of post-surgical medieval cauterization. Therapeutic treatments based on humoral theory extended far beyond bloodletting, or perhaps extended to other practices tangentially related to bloodletting. And one of those practices was treatment by fire. Cautery, like bloodletting, has a pronounced historical lineage. The first culture to use it is unknown, but what we do know is that from very ancient times, a wide variety of civilizations across the world believed that fire contained therapeutic properties. Hippocrates himself prescribed red-hot irons to incinerate hemorrhoids, to be followed up with a healing poultice of lentils and vegetables, of course. He believed that burning was a panacea, and if something couldn't be healed by the red-hot end of a poker or a slow-burning oil, then it was likely it probably couldn't be healed at all. Cautery was then later used by its proponents for just about everything. Cauterizing temples for headaches, as well as under the chin, or on the neck, or on the chest for things like upper respiratory distress. Cautery was also thought to be an aid for emotional and psychological maladies in the same way that bloodletting was. Part of the rationale behind cautery and blistering was something called counter-irritation. That essentially means intentionally irritating an area of the body to distract from the already wounded area. They were working under the assumption that this new irritation would draw away the sickness from the original wound and allow it to heal. One practitioner who advocated cautery was a New York physician named Dr. A.R. Carman. In 1882, when a young woman who had been bedridden for weeks due to headaches, insomnia, and overall malaise came to him for help, he treated her by way of creating a series of burns down her spine. Interestingly, the young woman recovered quickly and was able to go back to work. To him and to her family, this case was considered proof of the efficacy of counter-irritation cautery. These days, folks are still being cauterized in medical settings, but it takes a far less gruesome form than you might imagine. Gone are the days of the stench of singed, burning flesh. Today, the instruments are a lot more precise and are deployed in far fewer circumstances than days gone by. And people still willingly employ counter-irritation methods. In fact, you can pick them right up at your local drugstore. So the next time you go out for a run and find that your muscles are sore, rub in some Icy Hot or some Tiger Balm, anything that might contain menthol or capsicum. The magic is in the distraction and the subsequent peace of mind that they give you. Something that I highly doubt an iron poker ever could.
Grim and Mild presents Bedside Manners was executive produced by Aaron Mankey and narrated by Aaron Mankey and Robin Minotaur. Writing for this season was provided by Robin Minotaur, with research by Sam Alberti, Taylor Hagerdorn, and Robin Minotaur. Production assistance was provided by Josh Thane, Jesse Funk, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. You can learn more about this show, the Grim and Mild team, and all the other podcasts that we make over at grimandmild.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
You've probably heard a lot about electrified vehicles lately. Well, Toyota has electrified options for every lifestyle. We've got hybrids, no plug needed.
All right, let's go.
But we also have plug-in hybrids, if that's your thing. You can even go 100% electric in the Toyota BZ4X. With so many options for reducing carbon emissions, Toyota is electrified, diversified. Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.